Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome again to our Denton's Perspectives, which is our daily briefing from the Republican and Democratic conventions, which we're offering to our friends around the globe. We thank you all for joining, and as you know, if you've been on our previous two calls on Monday and Tuesday, we gather here to discuss the stories and policies behind the headlines each day with those who shape them and understand them best. I'm Kathleen O'Connor, a member of Denton's Public Policy and Regulation Practice, and I'll be the moderator for this morning's program. Today, we'll be joined by former Bush White House Political Director Ron Kaufman. Ron serves as a member of the Republican National Committee and sits on the Rules and Executive Committee. He's from Massachusetts, which his accent will reveal shortly, but he does have an unparalleled view of the palace intrigue we're seeing this week in Cleveland. We are also pleased to be joined by former Vermont governor and presidential candidate, Governor Howard Dean, who joins us to represent the other side of the aisle. Both gentlemen are members of the Denton Public Policy team, and we're thrilled that they could be with us today. This program series, from the moderated discussion that we're about to undertake to the policy forum with our head of our energy practice, will, and another member of our Denton Public Policy team, will all be considered on the record. A recording of this will be available midday on our website, www.denton.com. Everyone listening can find out more about the topics we're discussing this morning by following us on Twitter at Denton. And with that, I'm going to begin with Ron Kaufman from Cleveland. Ron, why don't you give us a recap of really what you heard last night and if you had any surprises you heard last night.
Thanks, Kathleen. A really good night last night for Trump and Republicans. It was a night to do two things, to begin the definition of who Donald Trump, the man, really is. It's true that all spoke and all did a spectacular job, particularly Donald Trump Jr. And American public really don't know Donald Trump that well as a human being. For those of you who followed the politics 4 years ago, after the campaign when Mitt Romney lost, there was a special TV documentary on Mitt the Family, if you will, and it gave a personal side of Mitt Romney. Many, many people said if that had aired beforehand, he may have had a better chance. And I think out of the convention yesterday and building to Thursday, Americans will see a different side of Donald Trump and figuring out who this man really is, and I think it will be a huge victory for him. The other part of last night was talking about the problems that Mrs. Clinton brings to the table. And I think that particularly Governor Christie of New Jersey laid out perfectly the persecution of her record. And I think, in fact, it was stark and honest and straightforward and very effective. So we had a very good second day, and the overnight polling data internally that folks see internally show that that Donald Trump has gained significantly in these last 2 days, and we're looking forward to tonight.
Oh, that's great. Well, tonight, as we know, we've got the Indiana Governor Mike Pence will probably deliver one of the most important speeches of his long political career, which spans a decade in the United States House of Representatives, when he accepts the Republican nomination for vice president this evening. But in many ways, he's much more, and you know this, Ron, very well, but I'm directing the question to Governor Dean. In many ways, he's so much more conservative than his running mate Donald Trump, whether it's the war in Iraq, on spending, on Planned Parenthood. How is he going to thread that needle tonight on his own conservative views while still respecting the opinions of his would-be boss?
Well, first of all, it pains me to disagree with Ron, but we'll find out what the polling shows after this. I thought the first night was a disaster. I happened to see the evening news, which I don't very often, and they had this incredible, devastating video of Michelle Obama and Melania Trump giving exactly the same speech, word for word, at the same time. So that was the end of night one. Night two, you know, it's interesting to see what people remember. What struck me about Chris Christie's speech is it reminded me a lot of Pat Buchanan's speech in Houston. Basically, you had a lynch mob. And I think that's what the American people are going to remember. Everybody, you know, family was fine. It was very nice. What they're going to remember is the call and response of, lock her up, put her away. I think Chris Christie made himself unconfirmable for attorney general. He may end up being the chief of staff if Trump wins, although I don't think that's going to happen. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know what the internal polling was. It was not, I mean, I guess I could say, may you have two more nights like last night and the night before. To get to Pence, I think Pence is, for this crowd, for the purposes which he was evidently chosen, I think he'll be fine. He's very, very conservative, way outside the mainstream of where most Americans are. But I think he does help with the conservative wing of the party, who has been somewhat restless. I think probably most people don't pay attention to the vice president's vice presidential nomination speech in either party. I don't think I think we said on the first day that the vice president doesn't. The last time a vice president really made a big difference was in 1960, when Lyndon Johnson basically, shall we say, retained Texas for the Democrats. But I think that, Pence will do his job, which is to appeal to the very conservative people. You will get some attacks from our side on his views on abortion and gay rights, which are well known and I think well outside the mainstream of where Americans are. Probably, people don't really vote on the vice president. So you'll hear some noise from our side on that, but I don't think it's going to have an effect one way or the other. But I do think it'll shore up Trump among the true conservatives who are a little concerned about his views on things like gay rights, which are not as, left or right wing as some of them would like.
I'm really surprised, Governor Dean, that you didn't think Sarah Palin was kind of a vice presidential drill baby drill comment. We won't be hearing any of that tonight, I suspect. But I do
wonder.
Go ahead.
That was the equivalent of what Christie said yesterday. I was appalled by that speech. I thought it was the worst of the Republican. Republicans have a problem. 35% of their vote is what I call the hate wing of the Republican Party, and that's what Chris Christie showed last night. I just don't think that hate is a winning proposition. I think Trump has to overcome that in this convention, and so far I don't think he has.
Interesting. Ron, do you want to react to that, and do you want to talk about how at all Pence will even try to kind of thread the needle on the difference of the stark differences between himself and his running mate?
Well, sure, I'll be glad to. But to my friend, Governor Dean, NBC came out with a tracking poll last night that has, for the first time, Donald Trump ahead. So the way we're going, I'd love to have two more nights like the last two. When Americans watched Mrs. Trump on TV, they reacted very strongly, very powerfully, and looked at her as eloquent and as dignified as they could see, and could see her as First Lady. When it comes to Pence, there are two things you look for potentially from a vice presidential pick: either help you politically or help you govern. The best VP picks have nothing to do with politics, in my opinion. It's to help you govern. Ronald Reagan picked George Herbert Walker Bush, who had accused Ronald Reagan's economics of voodoo economics, but in fact helped him govern because he was an outsider. Bill Clinton took Al Gore for the same reasons. Barack Obama picked Biden for the same reason. And the reason that Donald Trump picked Pence, yes, he does help somewhat with a conservative base, but basically in our conversations, he told us he picked him because he can help him govern. Remember, Donald Trump has never spent a day in Washington, so to speak, in politics. So having someone who served in Congress, served on defense, served on foreign policy, is respected by both sides of the aisle, despite his conservative leanings, and also governed a state very, very well for these last 5 years, is exactly the kind of partner he needs when he is sworn in as president, and needs to have a running mate who can help him govern. So I think it's a very wise pick, and I think that as the aforementioned campaigns, they were going to really it really helps govern the country.
Well, I'm interested in that, Ron, but and not really just for tonight, but long term. I mean, the last time Mike Pence stepped into the national limelight, he was in a considerably less than flattering hue when he took heat earlier this year from businesses and gay rights groups for signing a controversial religious liberty bill. Do you think he'll either use that speech tonight to explain that decision? Does he ignore it altogether? Do you have any insight on kind of what direction he's going to go tonight and how those two, meaning Trump and Pence, are going to handle those kind of differences going forward through the campaign? Or will they just ignore it and rely on
politicians? Sure. Every politician has differences with a running mate. Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy weren't exactly best friends in 1960, but it did work. And this is not about Pence. This is about Donald Trump. And I think that Pence will do a good job of helping to unite the party. And the theme of today is going to be unity. Not only is Pence going to speak, but we're going to have a former speaker, Newt Gingrich, who's also with us at Denton's, and three or four of the other candidates that ran for president this time. So this is going to be a unifying day, unifying evening, and I think Pence will speak more to that than the past. And I think we're going to have another good night.
So let me ask you, Governor Dean, do you think that Pence's selection in some way or in any way affects Hillary Clinton's calculus? I mean, Pence in many ways is a safe pick for Donald Trump. Does that make Secretary Clinton, do you think, more inclined to make a political choice like Senator Elizabeth Warren, putting two women on the same ticket, or Julian Castro naming a Latino American? Do you think any status on the Republican side on the VP has any impact at all on what her decision is ultimately going to be?
I don't know. I do agree with Ron that the first criteria for anybody should be somebody who can help you govern and somebody who's capable of taking over if, God forbid, the president should not be able to continue. But I don't have a clue here. As I said the other day, the only tea leaves that I have access to are the release of the speakers that are already scheduled, and the two that were not on the list were Tim Kaine and Elizabeth Warren, which means potentially they could be being saved for a Wednesday night slot, which is the traditional slot for the VP on our side. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know what, I mean, you know, she is so capable and so able to govern and knows, I mean, she's probably got the best resume maybe ever of anybody to run for president. George H.W. Bush would come to mind as somebody who had a similar kind of extraordinary resume. So she doesn't need what Trump needs. And you know, I'm sure they're doing all the things that every side does during these things. I'm sure they're doing poll testing. They're doing compatibility. Compatibility matters, because otherwise you start getting stories about rifts, and that is never a good thing when you're the president. So I wish I could give you some insight into this. I mean, I could speculate and make something up, but I truly have absolutely no idea who she's going to pick other than the inside gossip, which is relatively worthless because in Washington about this matter, those who know don't say and those who say don't know. So I don't know. I don't have a particular clue except for the little tea leaves that I just told you about, which make me think that Kaine and Warren are still very much in the running.
Interesting. Yeah, and go ahead, Ron.
I agree with the governor. I think she has more flexibility because of her resume. Now, I would say, unlike the governor, that resume is going to hurt her in the end in a cycle where, in both parties, the outside candidates had huge momentum going into to the conventions. So my guess is she does have flexibility. My guess is she will go more political than Donald Trump had a chance to do.
Interesting. And then tonight, Ron, we've got, in addition to Newt Gingrich in the lineup, there's also Ted Cruz, who's speaking tonight, presumably in a sign of party unity, since he was Trump's biggest rival during the primary. But earlier this week, the Cruz supporters were trying to advance rules that they believe would prove helpful to the senator in a 2020 primary. So do you think Cruz is simply biding his time until 2020, or do you think he's honestly in Trump's camp? Do you have any insight on what was going on the Rules Committee or anything like that?
Yeah, sure. Since I was co-chair of the rules, I lived through that interesting week of back and forth. And it really wasn't about Donald Trump at all. It really was about the future. And Ted Cruz comes from the conservative wing of my party, and he was looking to protect his options for the future. And we're trying to make, candidly, our party a little bit smaller in some respects and make it all our elections closed, meaning independents and Democrats couldn't vote. So the conservative base would be bigger in that case. But it was overwhelmingly rejected by a party who had our best, broadest, biggest turnout in the history of our party or our country. So, but he also understands that Donald Trump's the nominee. So I think, like a lot of folks, this is a binary choice we have. We have two options, not three, not four, two options. This is Mrs. Clinton and Donald Trump. And no matter who, of the 17 people who ran, folks really wanted to support, the bottom line is they have two options, and I think those two options will bring our party to be very unified after this convention.
And so tonight, I mean, we'll probably hear a lot less of the rhetoric of lock her up and the kind of, you know, dangers of Hillary, of President Hillary, but maybe a little bit more about the virtue of President Trump. It's hard not to read into that, you know, lock her up dynamic that you're on the ground out there, Ron. I mean, do you get a sense that people, even those who have publicly endorsed Donald Trump, are voting against Clinton rather than for Trump, kind of to your binary, you know, decision, I mean, the binary choice the voters have to make? Do you think it's a fair assessment to say that a large majority of those Republicans out there are really just voting against Clinton, and that's kind of the play that the entire campaign is going to make?
No, I wouldn't. I think this. I think they believe the polling data, both candidates, both Mrs. Clinton and Donald Trump, are two of the most unpopular nominees in polling history. So they both have problems. I think a majority of the folks in the hall last night in this town are increasingly strongly supporting Donald Trump. Keep in mind, he was the outside candidate. These people don't really know him. So as they've gotten to know him better through this process, they're more and more pro-Donald Trump than just anti-Hillary. In Philadelphia next week, Mrs. Clinton's got the same problem. 45% of her delegates, 45% support Bernie Sanders. And I think that's going to be a problem for her. They're pulling her hard to the left, as Mr. Sanders was, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out next week. But both these candidates, candidly, have concerns about uniting their parties.
Let me just, this came up yesterday, let me just reiterate that the interesting thing about the so-called pulling hard to the left is that actually most Trump supporters endorse some of the same kinds of things that Sanders endorsed. Most people in this country, the huge majority, believe that the minimum wage ought to be $15. Most people in this country believe that Medicare and Social Security should be left as is or even expanded. They do not believe they should be privatized. So, I actually think this business about quote-unquote pulling people to the left is kind of old rhetoric. I think people are tired of hearing about the right and the left and the conservatives and the liberals. I think that what they want to do is find out actually what somebody's going to do for ordinary working people who've been left behind by globalization. And so I see Senator Sanders' contribution as a positive one, not a negative one. I think he's going to actually improve the platform significantly.
In terms of getting elected,
I'm not saying economically it improves it because we all have to, you know, nobody's bothering to talk about money and balancing the budget. But, I mean, in terms of appeal to the voters, I think Sanders has actually made Hillary a more appealing candidate.
With all due respect, my dear friend, this election is about two dynamics more than anything else. It's a dynamic on one, and they're opposing each other in a way. One is the demographics of our country, which unfortunately today does help the Democrats and Mrs. Clinton, no question about that. But the other force, which is equally as strong and maybe even bigger, is the mood of of the country, and the mood of the country is sour right now. 45%, 45% more people feel this country is going in the wrong direction than the right direction. 45%, highest in many election cycles. It is a problem that's going to drive this election. People want change, and they want an outsider. Two strong things to have on your side. And that's Donald Trump, certainly not Mrs. Clinton. So that mood of the country versus the difference in demographics is going to decide this election in the end. And it's going to make this election, in my opinion, really, really close.
Well, and Governor Dean, you know, you've seen you've seen Secretary Clinton, you know, which is kind of, I think, unusual, on the campaign trail this week in some key battleground states. And I think we're going to see her continuing to pound the pavement in those states as the week continues. Do you have any thoughts on that strategy and that approach?
I do. I've actually already been approached because, I'm very much with Hillary and have been for about 2 years because of her capabilities. I've actually gotten the request of where they'd like me to be. And it's an interesting group of states is different than the usual swing state. Pennsylvania's on the list. That hasn't been a swing state for a long time. Obviously, Ohio is on the list. Florida is on the list. Colorado is on the list. Virginia is on the list. North Carolina, Hillary is up by 2, which is pretty extraordinary. That was a come-from-behind state for Obama. I think was, in my view, the biggest surprise of the campaign in 2008. So where I'd agree with Ron is the election is not going to be the same as it was. I do think he's right that the demographics favor us in that way. But I also think he's right about the sort of the mood of the country. And I also think he's right about this being a very, very close election. I don't think the map has changed dramatically, but I think it has changed because the stuff that I have been asked to do has obviously been driven by the polling, and the map is somewhat different. I think the big problem for the Republicans, I think they do have a shot in Pennsylvania and Ohio. The problem is, I think they're not going to win Florida for them and because of the demographics. And that's going to be an enormous problem because I think even if you win Ohio and Pennsylvania as a Republican, it's really hard to win if you lose Virginia and Florida, which I think is incredibly likely.
Well, and that might speak to why she's down. I think she's down in Florida this week, right?
Yeah, she was in Ohio, actually, earlier, too.
Yeah. And so I find that, unconventional would be the
word. It is unconventional, that's right.
Yeah,
right.
But I think I'm surprised by the aggressiveness, and I think it speaks to, and it's kind of, and I defer to you, Ron, on this, but the juxtaposition between these two campaigns. One looks aggressive, ready for prime time. I mean, obviously the Clintons have done this before. And then we see some of the, I don't want to say disorganization, Ron, but the lack of ready for prime time, for lack of a better word, on the Republican and Trump side. Do you have any thoughts or comments on that, Ron?
Both. One, I've heard this from particularly the media and the DNC for the last year about the Trump campaign. And they're running against 17 other really good candidates. Governor Bush of Florida, 4 or 5 senators, a couple other governors, Governor Kasich from here in Ohio. And the net result is he clobbered them. I think we have to accept the fact that we step back and say everything we know about politics is changed for lots of reasons. Changed because of the internet, changed because of social media, changed because of the impact of, in this country, of some of the shows on TV. It's just different. And Donald Trump somehow is ahead of all of us in understanding how to bring that all together. And add that to the mood. And the mood here, quite frankly, for the folks on the phone, is the same as it is in EU in many respects across the world. People are frightened. They're scared of terrorism. They're scared of what the economic impact of all this is going to be on their countries. And they are desperate for a different direction. It's very clear here, the one thing people want is change. And the question is, does Donald Trump represent that change. He's proven in primaries he has. The polls about today show he is gaining ground in that. If out of this convention, he can come away with a better personal side, a more open Donald Trump, if you will, to who he really is, you add that to his ability to capture the change, make a difference vote, I think he's going to be in really strong shape. And I do believe it's not going to be which states do you win. I believe it's going to be a wave on how people receive him, his ability to lead a country in a different direction.
Interesting. And do you think, Ron, that we're going to hear anything, speaking of change and kind of the mood, at some point during this convention, maybe we have to wait till Thursday night when the candidate himself speaks, but are we going to hear a little more about the positive ways the Trump administration might try and change public policy? I mean, you know, tonight is all about make America first again, first in trade, first in energy, and the hallmark of his campaign, and it's expected to bleed into the speeches tonight, but we haven't really heard much from Trump as to how he tends to accomplish that. Do you think we'll start seeing some of that today and tomorrow?
I think good conventions evolve. And I think as we evolve toward Donald Trump's speech on Thursday night, I think you'll see more and more of that. But what conventions are not are places for big policy speeches. And I think, quite frankly, the policy aspect of this campaign for both sides will be more on the debates we have going down the line, the two or three debates the two candidates have. But this is more about bigger picture, and I think that making sure that Donald Trump is well perceived, and I think his speech on Thursday night will be probably the most watched political speech in history. And if you come out of this convention right, and that speech on Thursday night hits it, he's well on his way. There are three things that decide the campaign at this stage. One is the VP pick, and I think we had a good one. Two is the convention, and I believe we're going to have a good one. Third is the debates, and if the debates go well for Donald Trump, he'll be the president.
So I have one question, which is actually addressed to Ron. Donald Trump is the only president probably in the last 40 years or presidential candidate who's not released his tax returns. That's going to be an enormous issue because it speaks to his honesty. What's the plan to deal with that? Because we're obviously going to make that an enormous issue if he doesn't release his tax returns.
I hope you spend a lot of money on it, Governor, a lot of ads on that issue. I don't think the American people particularly care. I wish he would. It's not my call. I would do it if I were him, quite frankly. And he may do that. But I don't think it will make a difference. I think in the primary process, a lot of the other 17 candidates raised that issue. A lot of outsiders raised that issue. And no one cared. And it may be good, it may be bad. It's just the truth. So if that's going to be the issue that the Democrats will hang their hat on, but whether Mrs. Clinton should win or Donald Trump wins, it's going to be a great November for the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, I think it goes to his honesty, and I think that is going to be a big issue.
I'm not sure how you say that it's going to go to his honesty, yes or no, but the bottom line is the voters don't care. They want change. They're tired of the last 8 years, particularly in foreign policy, and they want someone new.
I think it's interesting, Governor Dean, that you think that the Clinton campaign would want to focus on honesty when her unfavorables on that issue are so high. But I think I understand your point on the lack of transparency and disclosure.
Well, I mean, the reason we'd want to focus on honesty is precisely because Hillary's numbers are not as good as we would like in that area, although we think those will improve over time. If you have a choice between somebody who's really experienced and knows what they're doing and somebody who isn't really experienced and doesn't know what they're doing, and you have concerns about the honesty of both of them, then you're going to pick the person who knows what they're doing. You know, when Ron was talking about people wanting a change, it's true, they do, but they also realize that there's risk in change. And, And obviously, our strategy is going to be to portray the risk of having somebody like Donald Trump in office as a risk that people can't afford to take. And I think in the minority communities, that they've already made that decision. That's a done deal. And the question is now, what are we going to do in the majority community, and how is that going to work?
I had the pleasure of being in a very interesting focus group done by neither Republican or Democratic Party, but some business interests, and they asked this very question: which is more important to you, risk or change? Because I think the governor's right. That's exactly where they are. And surprisingly, 40% said they're worried about risk, but 60% said risk, change is more important to them than risk. And I think it's a fundamental question of where we are as a nation. Again, I believe that, and I think Donald Trump believes, change will trump. It usually does. Just like Ronald Reagan was a risk in 1980, in all honesty, and that risk proved to be worth it. And the bottom line, if Donald Trump makes the case that that risk is worth it, he'll win. And if he doesn't, he won't.
I agree.
It's kind of that simple.
Interesting. Well, thank you both. We have concluded our conversation here, and we're going to continue our conversation for the next 15 minutes. And again, Governor and Ron, thank you so much for your time. We're going to continue with Clint Vince, who's who is the leader of Denton's global energy practice. And Clint is going to talk with us today a little bit about the differences between the two candidates on their energy policy and also some of the game-changing trends. I mean, tonight's theme, as many of you have heard and I referenced earlier, is making America first again. And one of the key elements of that is going to be the approach to American energy independence. And so the 2016 presidential nominees have starkly different views on energy and environmental policy that reflect the growing divide between Republicans and Democrats on many of these issues. As everyone who reads the headlines knows, Donald Trump has largely dismissed climate change science as bunk, and he's proposed an energy plan focused on increased production of fossil fuels that establish, you know, as he puts it, American energy dominance as a strategic, economic, and foreign policy goal. Secretary Clinton describes the climate change as an urgent threat, pledging to accelerate the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and make Americans the world's clean energy superpower. Secretary Clinton prefers to view all future energy developments through the lens of the climate change policy. So we obviously have dramatic differences between the Trump and Clinton camps on how they're likely to generate, and those are going to generate substantial attention, I think, in the general election campaign, particularly in closely contested battleground states that we were just referring to, such as Colorado, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, where energy and environmental issues are especially important. So I'm very pleased to be joined by the head of Denton's energy practice, my colleague, Clint Vince. Clint, do you want to take it from there?
Thank you so much, Kathleen. I think your introduction is exactly right. The voters will have a very clear choice between the two candidates this year. There will not be a lot of nuances. As you point out, the Trump platform really contemplates energy dominance as a cornerstone of their Making America First theme. The Hillary Clinton campaign really uses the term clean energy superpower and contemplates that climate change and climate policy would basically shape her energy policy. I think that with respect to the Trump platform, if you were to boil it down to a very simple phrase, it would be basically extraction and production. Extract more oil and natural gas and coal, and have the theme of energy dominance as really a key economic and foreign policy goal. Specifically, a Trump administration would seek to basically rescind all of President Obama's climate-related executive actions, including the Climate Action Plan. The platform would cancel the Paris COP21 climate agreement. It would stop all payment of U.S. dollars to U.N. Global warming programs. President Trump would request that TransCanada renew its permit application for the Keystone Pipeline. And it would also seek to save the coal industry. On the last point, we don't have many details. I think one of the problems that will be confronted is that coal has really been, I think, sideswiped by market forces even more than by any particular regulation or policy. And so that might be more challenging than a political phrase. Hillary Clinton's approach couldn't be more different. She would make America the world's clean energy superpower, expanding on President Obama's climate change and building on it. She would ensure that the U.S. honors the commitments that were made in Paris with the COP21 agreement. And as I mentioned, her climate policy would basically shape her energy policy. More specifically, a Clinton presidency would treat climate change as a national security issue. The Clinton campaign states that climate change, in fact, is the defining national security issue of our time, that it's causing refugees, rising sea levels, and turbulent weather. A Clinton administration would use clean air, clean energy to create high-paying jobs, and the centerpiece of the clean energy approach would be renewable power. For example, the Clinton platform would set a goal of installing 500 million solar panels on American homes by the end of her first term. She would also cut energy waste by focusing on energy efficiency in building codes and retrofits. And she has an additional goal of reducing oil consumption by one-third. So to sum that up, you have very, very clear and dramatic differences between the two candidates regarding energy.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Clint. And I think it's fair to say we'll all be kind of watchfully waiting to see what role, if any, this policy discussion takes within the debate. But I think it's one that Hillary Clinton is going to highlight and hit pretty hard, and Donald's going to hit pretty hard back on the American dominance. And I think we'll probably hear a little bit of that tonight in the Make America First kind of mantra in Cleveland. Do you see any other trends, Clint, in the energy space that are going to get attention outside what the candidates have already articulated? I mean, anything in the markets that are going to drive or move this conversation, in your view?
I think so. It's a very, very dynamic time in terms of trends. We put out a game changer publication. It's on our website, and we really focus on 10 game-changing events. The first is that oil and gas prices have continued to plummet, and we're seeing many oil-producing companies basically transition into the distressed asset category. I think Deloitte predicts that a third of all energy producers will be in a distressed situation this year. In terms of natural gas, we have the lowest prices we've seen in 12 years. Low natural gas prices have caused coal and nuclear new builds in the United States to really be sharply reduced. And they've also forced the early retirement of a lot of coal-fired generation and also now some nuclear power. So that's a huge trend that both candidates will be talking about. Donald Trump seeking to increase production and Hillary Clinton seeking to reduce production of fossil fuels in favor of renewables. The second game changer we've really discussed, and that is that climate policy will probably have a big impact on energy policy for the foreseeable future, certainly more so under a Clinton administration than a Trump administration, but the fact is that 190 countries signed on to the COP treaty in Paris, and we're now looking toward COP22 in Marrakesh, Morocco in November. The third game changer involves wind and solar, which have both increased geometrically in the United States and are expected to continue to do so. The tax extenders passed by Congress at the end of last year also will really promote wind and solar in the United States.
And let me ask you, Clint, do you feel like the Clinton platform of her very aggressive solar is, I mean, you've been in this space a lot longer than any of us. Is that doable? I mean, is it really doable?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, solar prices have dropped 80% in the last 5 years. It's not just doable, but it's happening. And I think that if you look at investment in jobs, the solar industry and soon the wind industry are really supplying the overwhelming majority of new jobs in the energy space. Coal industry has really been decimated. There are very few new jobs, and many existing jobs have been really dramatically reduced.
Does the administration, whether it's a Trump administration or Clinton administration, need to take proactive steps on the regulatory front to kind of further facilitate that or make it happen more than just organically?
I think what you're going to see is technology overtaking policy and regulation to some extent. Certainly the Clinton administration would rely more heavily on regulation, particularly with respect to carbon-related issues, probably a continuation of very aggressive action by the Environmental Protection Agency. I think Donald Trump would rely more on allowing fossil fuels to probably deregulating with respect to fossil fuels and having much more production.
Interesting. I appreciate that. I interrupted you on your trends. I apologize.
Well, the fourth trend I was about to mention is related to the huge increase in renewables, and that is the expectation that energy storage is going to play an ever-increasing role in the United States, energy and battery storage. What that does is it mitigates the intermittency issue for renewables. That is, when the sun doesn't shine, you don't have solar production. When the wind doesn't blow, you don't have wind production. Battery and energy storage basically solve that problem. The fifth game changer is more of a nuanced term. You'll hear in the future much more discussion of something called distributed energy resources. And that includes everything from distributed generation like rooftop solar, energy storage, microgrids, energy efficiency, much more demand side rather than supply side measures, and even electric vehicles. The sixth game changer involves brilliant machines and advanced data analytics. This is kind of a breakthrough that's not getting a lot of attention yet, but we're seeing generating sources like wind become 20 to 30% more efficient with data analytics. Even the placement of wind farms, where the turbines are located in proximity to each other, can achieve huge savings. The seventh game changer is empowered consumers, what you'll hear the term now, prosumers, which means that consumers will be much more active in purchasing electricity and affecting electricity supply issues than they have in the past. The eighth game changer is one that concerns many in our industry very, very deeply, and that is the threat of cyber and physical intrusion into our infrastructure. The Western Area Power Administration recently received about 600,000 hits on its firewall, all from a single foreign entity. You saw in Ukraine, Western Ukraine last January, the entire grid was shut down by a very sophisticated cyber attack. The knife game changer also is a threat, and that has to do with water scarcity and turbulent weather. Things like Superstorm Sandy, droughts in the Southwest and California, flooding in Houston. And the 10th trend that we mentioned is linked more to global demographics and predictions regarding urbanization. In 2014, 54% of the world's population lived in urban areas. By 2050, the expectation is that that number will be close to 70% of the world's population living in urban areas, and the challenges for energy and more sustainable cities related to that figure are profound and unsolved right now.
Oh, interesting. Well, Clint, we have to wrap it up here, but thank you so much for your insight. Thank you for those trends and also your thoughtful analysis of the two campaigns and the differences. It's really helpful, I know, to all of us listening. So thank you for your time, and thank everyone for joining us today. You can find an audio recording of this entire briefing on our website at www.dentons.com. And other than that, have a great day. We'll be here tomorrow morning, same time, same place, and we'll be back with more from Cleveland and more with Governor Dean. So thank you all, and have a great day.